VIP Conduit presents Getting to Know You for February 2022. This month, we have a very special edition. To tell us more about the interview, here is our host, Susie B.
Well, welcome everyone to tonight's edition of Getting to Know You. This is a recording that I think you will enjoy, and the only thing I can say that I had to do with this is I just suggested that he be interviewed. Some of you may have heard this recording before, but you will recognize some voices in here that perhaps you haven't heard in a long while. So sit back, and here we are with Getting to Know You, Pig Robbins.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Blind Like Me, Phil Park, coming into your homes again on Friday night, if you're hearing this first time on ACB Radio, and you may hear it somewhere else, so it may not be Friday night. Anyway, welcome to a little show we call Blind Like Me, which is as good a title for this thing, I guess, as any. Our guest today is a gentleman named Hargis Robbins from Nashville, Tennessee, sir. Good morning. How are you?
Morning, Phil. I'm doing fine.
You are, as like I mentioned Friday, much better known to musicians than you are the public. Correct me if I get anything wrong. You've played piano on hundreds of sessions in Nashville.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been doing it since, I did my first one in 57.
57?
Yeah, so I'm 48 years sometime this summer. I don't remember what day I joined, but I remember it was in the summertime.
Joined that musicians union in Nashville?
Yeah.
And you have developed several different styles of playing piano and are just obviously in demand, because you're still making a living doing that, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've been lucky to still be able to give them something they can use, you know.
Well, you've been lucky and you're good. You know, barring that, I've heard lots of things. The most, you know, one of the most memorable things, God, I hope you played this. Did you play on, or you wouldn't remember, a song called 14 Karat Mine that Gene Watson did that has heavy left-hand piano?
Yeah, that was me.
Every time I hear that, it just blows me away. I just love it. It sounds like a three-ton piano hitting, you know, dropping on you.
Yeah, that was a big old 9-foot Chickering.
Is that right?
Yeah, man, and it had a left hand on it. I'll tell you, it had a bass section.
Well, you got a left hand, to have done that with your left hand, it just knocks me out. But you know, we won't go into the thousands of recordings that you've played on, because they've been so many, and for big people, and you know, for big stars, and for little people just trying to get started, and all kinds of folks, right?
Oh, yeah. You never know. You know, when a lot of people say, why do you still work for somebody, you know, that's never been heard? You know, well, you never know when somebody comes through that will turn out to be a big, big star, you know.
So, well, and besides that, they pay you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, you do. You get, you eat. You, we're blind, but we still got to eat.
Yeah, you're damn right.
Well, let's see. You're 60, what, 64, 65?
67.
67.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're teasing me pretty hard now about trying to find guests that are older than me. They say that really thins out the pool if you try to do that.
Yeah, I forgot, but I know you're not as old as I am, but you're 60-something.
I'm 64. Yeah. 64 in October, be 65. Fixing to hit 65, I guess then we could earn all the money we want when we're 65. You know, don't take it.
Yeah, 65 in so many months, yeah.
They don't take your Social Security away from you. Where were you? You're totally blind, right?
Yeah.
And you were born that way?
No, well, I had an accident when I was about 3 years old. I stuck a knife in one eye, and they didn't take it out, and then the other one went out from what they call sympathetic infection.
I've heard of that, but if they had removed the damaged eye, you might still have sight in the other eye. Is that right?
Yeah, supposedly, yeah, because it's happened to other people that way.
That's just weird, isn't it?
I don't understand it, but that was the story.
But that's the lot that's what you got, and so that's what you deal with.
That's right. And you know, I think I consider myself a lucky person anyway. But it happened when I was young, and it gradually went out, you know. And
yeah.
So as it went out, I got accustomed to doing things the blind way, you know.
Well, as we talk about all the time, I've decided now you're better off if you're able to see some, because you do remember colors a little bit. And
I remember we had an old green 37 Chevrolet, I think it was.
Really?
And why that sticks in my mind, I don't know. But
yeah. It's funny when you get older. When you get older, the things that you remember, you know.
Yeah.
They always say, I've heard old or used to hear old people say, "Well, I can't remember what I ate for breakfast, but I can tell you what happened 40 years ago."
Yeah.
And that is true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I got. I think you went to Tennessee School for the Blind, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Did you? You got brothers and sisters?
Got four brothers.
Four brothers.
Yeah, two older and two younger.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so there was lots of roughhousing going on at your house, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Had to be.
You bet.
And it was your lot. You had to keep up or get go under one of the two. So you.
Absolutely.
No, I don't suppose they probably at that age didn't cut you much slack.
Not a lot, no.
All right, so
I was out there digging for what they could get.
That's right. That's right. This was back in the 30s. You were born, what, 30s?
38.
38?
Mm-hmm.
And this was 1940, 1941. The whole war had just started. Times were tough everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
President Roosevelt. I wish he was here now. But anyway.
Yeah, tell me.
Yeah. Anyway, so the Tennessee School for the Blind, they started you out and started you in Braille. And from what I've heard, Tennessee School was a pretty good school, blind school to go to.
Well, I didn't like school. I was like you.
you didn't like it.
I hated school.
I hated it.
But, you know, I got through it. I just tried to get along until I got in the 10th grade. I just tried to get by, and all at once, I guess when I started the 10th grade, it dawned on me that, you know, hell, you about got this thing licked, so
yeah.
why not try a little bit? So, you know, I made good grades, 10th, 11th, and 12th, and so, but I didn't want to go to college. I was sick of school.
Yeah, you'd had enough of school. But as a blind school goes, from talking to other people that have gone to the blind school, I from what I gather, of course, do you know Tim Hendel? Do you know who he is?
I've heard the name.
Tim Hendel is it? Tim Hendel went to Batavia School for the Blind.
Where's that?
That's in New York.
Okay.
And he is determined to convince me that blind schools were great, and he keeps sending me people to do on this show that tell me what a wonderful experience they had at a blind school. I hated every minute of it.
Well, they were too strict. I mean, my folks were strict, but, you know, they just crap like you had to eat some of everything on the table where you liked it or not.
Yeah.
Just all kind of junk, you know, if you had... You know, money, they put money, what they call money in the office that you could draw out every Saturday, you know.
And, yeah.
And we'd always make up a list of stuff that we needed, you know, whether we needed it or not. You know,
you had
a little extra money.
Had lots of toothpaste.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Polish.
Sure, had to have,
we never did polish our teeth.
I know. We had what we call ordering day.
Yeah.
And the house mother, old Crabby Abby Young, would go to town once a month, I think, and get stuff for us, like shoe polish and hair tonic, and my God, I had more toothpaste. I went home in the summer. I knew what to do with. But so that was it. That's a typical, I guess, a typical blind school. They start teaching you grade one Braille, then grade two gradually, and on to that. You read Braille still or not?
Not much. I never was a good Braille reader. I was slow at it, but, you know, of course, I did in school, but I never used it much after I got out.
Now, so that, I guess they had the normal things. They teach you to type and stuff like that, all those those kinds of things. In high school, did they have a band? When did your interest in music begin to blossom,
I was, let's say, about in the second grade, I guess, and they came around one day and wanted to know if anybody wanted to take piano. And so, you know, I'd been hearing things on the radio, and I thought, man, yeah, I'd love to do that. And because I figured in a few weeks I'd be able to play what I was hearing on the radio.
Yeah, you'd be playing like Del Wood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Moon Mulligan.
Or Moon Mulligan, yeah.
You know, or hundreds of other. But anyway, I got in and, you know, learned little tunes like Skip a Key.
Yeah.
Airplane.
Just little tunes, simple
yeah,
tunes.
One finger deals, yeah. You know, one hand, and then, mm-hmm. You know, graduated you up to two hands and practicing all those scales and all that junk, you know. Well, I didn't like that, but the School for the Blind, Tennessee School for the Blind, was about like being in the Army. If you joined up for something, you were in it, whether you liked it or not. You
know? Yeah.
And so anyway, I hung in that, and then later I did play in the band, played trumpet in the band, and where you'd play marches and so forth.
Oh, in the actual with the high school, the regular band there at school.
Yeah, but I mean they started you out in about the fourth grade, I think, playing, you know.
Before we get too far off Moon Mulligan, when I first got in radio, the station I was working at set up a little studio in Houston, and they hired Moon Mulligan to come and do a little radio show, a little two-hour radio show. We taped it, and they'd send it to the radio station and play it the next morning. We didn't have any way of doing it live, so they'd play it the next morning. And he and I, they built us a little booth in the dining room there of this Las Vegas Motor Hotel in Houston. And he and I'd sit back there at night, and after everybody left, we'd close the curtains and drink beer and do this radio show. And I thought I'd met a star, and I had.
Yeah. Oh, I loved old Moon's playing. I never met him. He died before I think he died in 56 or 7, somewhere along in there, about the time I was getting started, maybe.
And well, you would have loved him. He was just regular folks.
Well, that's what I hear. The Bob Moore and some of the other guys around here that did work with him said he was a character.
There was nothing pretentious about him. He was just a regular old boy that enjoyed, was having a good time in life, and he wasn't bitter because you know, a lot of guys have a few hits and then they get mad because they don't keep having.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've been around people like that, had a hit or one or two, and mm-hmm. and then they're angry because they didn't become big stars or they aren't still having his. Moon wasn't. It wasn't anything pretentious or angry or unhappy about him. He was just you would have loved him. He was a regular what you'd say a regular Joe, or you know.
Oh, I loved him. His playing and singing and everything. I mean, you know, Selma Skip Alone, Cherokee Boogie, Pipeliner Blues, and all that stuff. Man, I loved it.
Well, and Selma Skip Alone, of course, was a major hit for him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Recorded it. I think I've got three or four versions of that. I guess they keep going back and recording stuff. So you managed to get through high school and actually did pretty good grades at the last year. Worked a little bit.
Yeah. Took a little interest.
What did you think? Were you playing well by then? Had you developed the ability to play by then?
Oh, yeah. I was playing in the summertime. I'd play in clubs, you know.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. We'd live out of rage and
yeah, I've been there.
All that kind of stuff, you know. And
I've been there.
And, you know, they wasn't as strict back then as they are now. And so, yeah, I was playing in clubs and the summer before I graduated, I worked in a dark room in a photo finishing place,
uh-huh.
stripping the paper off of the film and putting the weight on it and putting it over on the machine.
Putting it on that big roller that pulled it through and all the chemicals?
Yep, there you go.
That used to be a thing that lots of blind people did.
Yeah.
And of course, those days, we're into digital photography now, so I guess all those days are gone. In fact,
yeah, that was just black and white when I was working there. And well, color was in, but this guy didn't want to put out the money to buy the extra equipment for the color.
Yeah.
So anyway, I worked there that summer, and then when I graduated, I went back out there to, you know, have something so I could hang around Nashville. Because, man, back where I'm from, over in East Tennessee, you know, it wasn't nothing but either making moonshine or coal mining, you know. And
that's where you were. You were born in, I forgot to ask you where you were born in. You were born in over in East Tennessee.
Yeah, a little town called Spring City, Tennessee. It's about halfway between Chattanooga and Knoxville, I guess. And I worked over there, you know, and it's just typical.
Nothing
typical
to do.
Poor little town. You know?
Nothing to do over there, really. Do they coal mine or over there?
They did, yeah. Coal mine, make moonshine, right? Really, actually.
Coal mine making moonshine.
Yeah. Well, they did a little logging, too, but...
At my age, that doesn't sound too bad.
Well, don't do much moonshine anymore. They've turned it into a better cash crop, you know.
Yeah, they grow a little cannabis over there.
There you go.
Well, I guess, you know, to each his own. That, like I said, at my age, that doesn't sound too bad. But but you had no idea things were going to go in your life the way they went. You had no plan.
None at all.
No roadmap.
No, I just hung around, and I worked at that place through the week. I worked at night, and was off on Friday and Saturday, and that's how I could play in the clubs. And if I got 40 hours in, I could make $32 at that place because I was only making 75 cents an hour.
Yeah, that was the minimum wage then, I guess.
It was, yeah. And then I made... $6 on Friday night and $7 on Saturday at playing it.
I remember those. I remember those days. Well, the first club job I ever had, we got $6 a night during the week and $7.50 on Saturdays, and I thought I was rich.
I did too, man. God. I was living in this boarding house, got two meals a day, and the old lady was a good cook, man, and you know about. $3 for laundry. Hell, I thought I had the world of sale.
and it seemed like if I remember that the government gave me $70 a month or something. I don't know how they. It wasn't Social Security back then. It was a pension check or it was some kind of blind assistance check. But I think I got $70 a month. This government check, and then my little playing money, five nights a week, and then maybe sometimes go somewhere on Sunday afternoon and play. I thought I'm a millionaire. You know?
Yeah,
this is maybe life's not going to be too bad.
Yeah, you know? Well, we didn't have a assistance deal. I don't know when that did come along later, but it was after I got out of school and so forth.
It could have been from the state. I don't remember, but I remember. I remember getting it. I remember waiting on that check. It came on. Yeah, I don't remember what day it came on, but I remember waiting on that, being really happy when I got that check. That meant I could really do some
splurge a little bit,
do some drinking that night,
there
boy.
There you go.
And we're gonna have a big time. As I said earlier, any musician you talk to, I don't care who it is, young, old, or otherwise, knows of your piano playing. You're not nearly as well known to the public because you never had a hit record like the last day.
Record. I've had some albums out, but never a hit record. But more people know me by just Pig than anything. But with a name like Hargis, who in the hell can remember that?
Who in the hell can remember that? So you're not sensitive about Pig, about the
no,
name.
No,
that
no,
doesn't bother you.
Mm.
Good, because
that's what I just tell people. Say, what do you want me to call you? And I say, whatever you're comfortable with.
I've got a friend in Nacogdoches named David Stallings who produced some records, and he called me Friday and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I got an interview Monday morning with Hargis Pig Robbins," and he said, "Ah, Pig, let's go on down to the old barn." You remember that Bob Wills record, you know?
Yeah.
He's a big Bob Wills fan like I am, and so he remembered that.
Well, that was a big thrill to me to play with Bob, and it was because I'd heard of him all my life, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, it was in his later years, you know, and he was, you know, he was pretty sick, you know, but he'd manage to get up that microphone and still, you know.
Yeah, he'd get up there and play his little chorus on his fiddle, and then you could always tell when he was playing fiddle because he wasn't yelling, he wasn't talking.
That's right.
When he was playing fiddle.
Yeah.
But you did a little photo finishing, photo shop work or whatever you call it, photo lab or whatever.
Worked in the darkroom, yeah.
Worked in the darkroom. By the way, Don Patterson, while we're talking about darkrooms, Don Patterson was a supervisor at Fox Photo. Did real well as a darkroom tech. Don's got pretty good sight.
Yeah.
Don sees enough that if we were out of beer, I'd ride across the river with him.
All right, yeah. I've been out with some people like that, yeah.
Some half-blind people, legally blind people. I knew a kid named Charles Alexander, who I went to school with. Next thing I knew, the boy had a driver's license. I couldn't believe it. We rode all over everywhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you were doing that and playing on the weekends.
Yeah.
And playing some little club with a guy singing, playing.
Yeah, four-piece band.
Four or five.
Drums, piano, guitar, and bass.
Maybe bass if you could find anybody had one.
Yeah, that's right.
This was before electric bass got to be
such. That's right, yeah. And a lot of times we didn't even have a bass, you know, just we'd have like two guitars or something.
Yeah, and the guy he'd kind of thump rhythm on his
yeah. And, but you know, hell, he was making a racket. They didn't care.
Nobody cared. They'd sing those three, four chord songs be done with it. Did you do any singing back then?
A little bit. Not much. I never did excel at that.
What did Ernest Tubbs say? Used to you. You'd go in and hang your two speakers on the wall and set up your two little mic stands in your Bogan PA set and play. Now they come in with van loads of stuff, you know.
Absolutely.
And that's the way it was back then.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Back in this. This was, I guess this was, let's see, you're born 38, 48, 58. So yeah, this was mid-50s.
Yeah, this was 50. See, I graduated in 55, so it's, 55, 56.
And the world had discovered what to call rock and roll then.
Yeah, rockabilly.
Rockabilly.
Yeah.
You'd heard Jerry Lee Lewis play piano, and I'm sure loved it.
Absolutely. A lot of shaking, you win again.
Oh, man.
Balls of fire.
Yeah, that was right up your alley. So I guess they probably, I'm sure in the clubs on the weekends, they'd ask you to do those. And Little Richard was playing piano, all those guys.
Oh, yeah. Long tall Sally.
Yeah. And so you were playing in clubs and working in photo finishing. And what happened? I mean, how did you get from there to where you are? Not to where you are now, but to the beginning. How did it start? What happened?
Well, I met this man and woman that were songwriters and
anybody we'd know.
Kind of chipped in together, you know, and we'd make our home demos and we'd take them around to the publishing companies and see if we could get any interest in them, you know.
Now, with the songwriters, would there be anybody we'd know?
No.
They weren't Bootalo and Felicia Bryant or anybody like that?
No.
Okay.
But anyway, we, it was Red and Mary Biggs, people, and they had some songs written. But anyway, people would comment about the piano playing. Also, and so, and they knew this guy named Murray Nash. He was a old time guy in records. He worked for Mercury and RCA and Acuff Rose. And so anyway, he was out on his own then and trying to start his own label. So we got, you know, all together with them and we just. We'd make our demos at home, and we'd walk uptown, which is 3 or 4 miles, I guess, because, hell, we didn't have money for the bus, you know.
Yeah, didn't have a car.
Well, they were blind, too, or partially. You know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, they were both partially blind.
Yeah.
One of them played rhythm guitars or what?
Right, yeah.
And demos, how'd you make demos? Did we have tape?
Webcore or something like that.
Well, but we had tape recorders, didn't we?
Yeah.
So you'd make them on tape, and y'all, this blind couple, with guide dogs or canes or what?
No, canes.
Just the old cane.
Well, this the guy could see well enough to get around.
Okay. So he kind of led everybody.
Yeah, we'd hang on him.
So y'all trotted uptown with your demos. That's funny.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. It's great stuff.
Yeah. And anyway. In 57, this Murray Nash guy, he was going to do some master sessions, and so he taught me into joining the union. And I went over and had to lie about my age because I was only 19 then.
Uh-huh.
I was supposed to be 21. The old guy said, well, you can't never tell the age of these big guys. And so, you got your money, $125?
Yeah, I got $125?
$125 to join the union.
That was a fortune back then.
Yeah, it was.
It was.
Scale was 41 and a quarter.
For
3 hour session.
For how much?
3 hour session.
For 3 hour session.
Yeah.
And they did what they could do in that 3 hours.
That's right, yeah.
And if they started a second 3 hours, you got paid another 41 and a quarter.
Yeah, there you go.
But you had to be in the union in order to play at the studio that you were.
That's right.
So $125, good God Almighty.
Well, that was a lot of saving up from them $13 a week.
Yeah, a lot of that's what I was going to say. That was a princely sum. And
well, but then I had got in with another guy that was working up at Fort Campbell, some of the NCO clubs and so forth, and hell, he was making $20 a night up there, man. That was really tall cotton.
Yeah, that was some bucks.
Yeah.
$20 a night.
$20
a night.
I can remember they had no upright piano, and I would beat the hell out of that thing trying to be heard up with those electric guitars,
yeah,
and drums.
Yeah, had to.
And half the notes wouldn't play on that thing when I got through at night, but I'd go back and next time they would work. Boy, I don't know.
Did you?
I don't know who was keeping that thing up.
But I was going to say, did you take piano tuning and repair in school, or did they even have that at Tennessee?
They did have it, but I was one of those that I slept through. I took it for a credit.
Took it for credit, but you really didn't learn?
Didn't learn a lot, no.
But you learned enough to, if a key was sticking, did you learn enough to move it around and get, you learned that much?
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
How to do a little bit. Last time I tried to run a temperament, I got a set of vibes, and I cheated. I used the vibes and ran the temperament. I just couldn't do it. I tried it.
I never did learn to do the temperament. Never learned how many little waves you had to have in and all that. I could tune a unison or octave, but I never could learn the beginning, the temperament.
See, that's amazing, because it's obvious you have a hell of an ear for music, but you couldn't, you didn't want to. You didn't want to.
No.
Anyway, so you play this piano, and of course the guitars by then were electrified and playing loud. And
oh yeah.
You were playing, trying to, there's no way to amplify that piano back then, was there?
Well, we tried dropping the mic inside it, you know, but,
That never works well.
No, it never did. And but then Chuck Berry was coming along with that.
Yeah. loud guitars and that.
And all you could hear was maybe a little real high notes on the piano.
Yeah. And so you joined the union in order to work this session with, what was the guy's name you said?
Murray Nash was the guy that was producing it.
It was producing the session.
It was for a label out of Ohio. They back then, it was during the period of time when you could cut a master and take it to New York, and if they liked it, you know, you might spend $1,000 or $1,500 on it down here in Nashville and take it to New York and get $5,000 or $7,500 out of it.
If they thought they could do something with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, that was a big increase in money for whoever was doing it. So, you know, they did that for a while. And but anyway, I worked at one session that day, and I didn't get another session for 3 or 4 months. So.
Really?
Yeah.
But you'd already spent your hundred. It was for a year. Or they have yearly dues, I guess. But that was the joining fee, that $125.
Yeah. But you have to pay, like, if you had money coming through the local area, you had to pay a percentage, you know, to get your
of your session.
Yeah, what's called tax.
And you worked that one session.
Yeah.
And did anything come out of that session?
Not really.
Nothing I would have heard of.
No.
And you didn't get another one for several months.
3 or 4 months, yeah.
And you were still playing weekends and working in the photo place. And
well, no, but then I'd see the 57. Yeah, photo business had slowed down because it'd gone mostly to color.
Yeah.
And they didn't need a night guy then, so.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else already had the day job tied down. So
you began depending on music strictly.
Yeah, right.
5 nights a week and Sunday afternoons or whatever.
Well, I never made it to 5 nights a week. It was basically weekends, you know.
Yeah.
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday sometimes. But you were
a single man then? You had no one to depend on, no one depending on you except you.
Right.
Which, in that situation, is probably better.
Oh, yeah.
Probably a whole lot better.
Yeah.
All right, continue. Then you got to the next session. Nothing happened there?
No, it was, well, I got, we take our songs to Buddy Killen and Baker Row Tree. I know you've heard of Tree.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe even Buddy Killen because he
sure.
did it. But anyway, Buddy Killen got me on a George Jones session in 58.
Okay.
Which was White Lightning. And he come out in 59, but we cut it in 58. And then it was the number one in 59. And then
I'm trying to remember now, the bridge in White Lightning is a piano ride, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fast.
Yeah.
That bridge in White Lightning, I was just trying to remember. I wish I'd known that. I'd have played it for it. Okay. I remember, and so you played on that session.
Yeah.
I'll be damned. And it was a big hit song.
Yeah, that was the first hit I'd played on. I'd played on some others. And the business was growing back then. When I got in, they didn't have two studios. That was Bradley's and RCA. And they booked everything around, you know, which they Bradley's was on 16th. RCA was on 17th, right? All I had to do was walk across the street. So they booked everything around a certain little group. A little band, you know, a group of musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then things had started. The business was growing, and so you know there was room for another group of people.
Another band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I got in that way, kind of, and then about 60, Don Pierce built Starday, which is that was out on Dickerson Road.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that opened up other possibilities. And Chet and Owen started hearing about, you know, some of the things I'd done. And they would call me when, like, Floyd Kramer was the piano man then.
Yeah.
And so he... they would call me, you know, if he was double booked or wanted to go fishing or something like that.
Or had it something. By then there were four studios, so he's playing somewhere else where you got.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because the Hayride was over then, and he had moved to Nashville.
Yeah.
So I remember when Floyd Kramer was the piano player on the Louisiana Hayride.
Yeah.
Played on Mexican Joe and Caribbean and all those old Abbott records 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And I thought he was tremendous then. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
And so you began to, you said that there was a room for another group of musicians. Would I know any of the musicians that were in this new group that they started using?
Oh, well, Junior Husky was the bass player.
Yeah.
And Willie Ackerman, the drummer. Pete Drake was in it.
Well, that's theirs, yeah.
Buddy Spiker.
Yeah, fiddle player, yeah. But you all weren't playing together at night.
No.
You were playing with some other folks for your nighttime jobs.
Yeah.
And so, away we go with Starday.
Yeah, it just started growing from there. And
played on that George Jones record, and George was on Starday then, I guess, or had he gone?
Yeah, Starday Mercury. It was kind of, I don't know.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Conglomeration.
Pappy Daly was involved in it.
Pappy Daly.
Yeah. I'm sure you know him.
I know Pappy Daly. I don't know Pappy Daly real well. I know well. I've met him, and I know who he is because he was a Houston man.
But he did George on up until, I guess, Tammy came along.
Probably. Well, and then, you know, way back in the hills, let him a Pappy Daly, and he had him a steal. He cut a version and finally said Pappy Daly in
it.
Harold Daly, it was instrumental in getting in lots of James O'Gwen and lots of those old Houston. There's a collection out of those old Starday things that I keep meaning to buy. I think there are three CDs of them, but I'd love to hear that old, because it just somehow country music just thrills me. There's something about those old mono recordings that I just love.
Yeah.
Anyway, you played on Tender Years.
Yep.
That beautiful first little kickoff for Tender Years. You got to play on all that stuff, and it just kept going, right?
Yeah. And then in 61, I guess it was, I played on I Fall to Pieces for Patsy Cline.
Really?
And then 62, Shelby Singleton come to town, and
I remember Shelby saying
he worked for Mercury, and we just did, God ain't no telling how many sessions we did for Mercury that year, and walking by with Leroy Van Dyke.
Yeah.
Oh, he brought everybody down from New York, Patty Page, and oh, I don't know, just a whole bunch, Brooke Benton. Oh, just a gobs of people. Besides the ones, you know, that were, he did James O'Gwen.
Really?
Yeah.
James O'Gwen.
Yeah.
I have no idea whatever.
When you mentioned his name a while ago, I was trying to think, he had a hit on Mercury. I just can't pull it out right now.
I can't even remember what it was, but, well, I heard it the other day on XM.
Yeah.
XM is going back and doing every country song that charted from 1950 through 2004.
Mm.
And of course, I'm recording it on CD, so you know, you'll have everything then.
Yeah.
And I heard this James O'Gwen song, but I can't. I'm like you. I can't come up with the name of it. But you'd already played on two major, colossal number one hit records, and that's Quiet Lightning and I Fall to Pieces.
Yeah.
So you know, when somebody said, "Who's that piano player?" Well, that's Hargis Pig Robbins.
Yeah.
Well, let's get him. So there. That's, you know, that got it going, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and then, like I say, the business just kept growing. More studios come along, and, oh, you know, Roger Miller come along in, 63 or 4, I guess.
Nobody in this world in country music was ever any more talented than Roger Miller.
I agree with you.
So I heard some old straight country shuffle beat kind of tunes that somebody did on him back before he got famous, and he was a great singer then.
He was, yeah.
And I heard.
He did. He was on RCA. Had some ballads and you know, more country type things before he got on Mercury and had the Jug Lug and Dang Me and King of the Road and all that bunch.
Everybody forgets that Roger wrote The Last Word in Lonesome Is Me,
yeah,
which was a hit for Eddie Arnold. And let's see, Think I'll Pick Up My Heart and Go Home.
Yeah,
and just a, you know, tremendous ballad singer.
I've Got Half a Mind to Leave You, I think.
Oh, you broke half a mind for Ernest Tubb? Yeah.
I think he did that.
I'm pretty sure he did. I heard somebody talking about that the other day. And I heard Mel Tillis doing an interview with Bill Anderson the other day, talking about Roger Miller. Said he hired him to go on the road with somebody. He said he was a fiddle player. He said, I didn't know if he could play the fiddle or not.
Yeah, Roger, he was hungry. He played drums, I think, for Fair Young or Price or somebody.
I think Ray Price for a while, maybe. And maybe he may have played fiddle for Ray Price.
He's not out. He'd do anything for a dollar.
Well, he was like the rest of us. He's hungry. You know, he wanted to
do things like that.
Say, you had a couple albums on your own.
Yeah.
Surely after Floyd Kramer had Last Date, somebody said, well, hell, let's see if we can do that again.
Yeah.
You know they did.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, I did one for Mercury back in, I don't know, 62 or 3. It was actually on Smash, but it was a division of Mercury.
Yeah, I remember Smash Records.
But it was, there was a dance going back then called the Hully Gully.
I remember.
And Shelby wanted to do hits, you know, that were out, like Mother-in-Law and things of that.
He did them as instrumentals.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you did that for him.
Yeah. That was the first one I done, and then I did the one for Time Records, and which I did some. I did some my own original stuff on that, and some things like Nightlife and some other stuff that's on there. Forever. I did one for Chart later, and Chart Records had Lynn Anderson.
Yeah.
First started, and oh, some others. Then I did three for Elektra, 77, 78, and 79.
Albums?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we need to transfer.
But I never had any success. I got some airplay and some sales, but wasn't nothing to write home about.
Well, you were doing quite well without that.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't play on the big session in nightlife, the Ray Price session, though, did you?
That's, yeah, I did.
That was you?
Yeah.
That's you playing piano?
Mm-hmm.
I'll be damned. I always thought that was Floyd Kramer, but that's you.
Yep.
One of the greatest sessions just for clean music ever done anywhere.
It was loose to say.
Well, it was loose, but it was together because there weren't very many of you. There was steel guitar, piano, obviously rhythm guitar, drums, and upright bass. That's all, isn't it?
That's about it, yeah.
And I don't know who's playing upright bass, but he was a hell of an upright bass man.
That was Joe Zinkin, I believe.
Well, he was right with you.
Either Joe or Bob. Bob Moore or Joe Zinkin, I can't remember.
He was right with you. I mean, he made every move. And you ever try to play an upright bass?
I have.
They're difficult, to say the least. They're difficult to play.
Hard on the fingers.
Oh, they're hard on the fingers. That's what I started out playing. I remember putting scotch tape on my fingers and trying to...
Yeah.
Now, there's another instrument that you got to play as hard as you can to be heard.
Oh.
It's like that piano.
Yeah.
When they started electrifying those guitars, it was, you know...
Yeah.
Of course, you could hear it good in the bathroom. But right there in front of it, you couldn't. And this old boy, of course, there's lots of upright basses are making a comeback. You hear them a lot more now than you did there for a while.
You do, yeah.
I listen to the jazz. There's a jazz thing on XM that I keep on most of the time, and all those folks use uprights. And there's some upright guys that just amaze me. I don't see how they do what they do.
Oh, I know it.
But that was quite a session. Just five of you. You wonder. Yeah, of course, that was they recorded that on tape, and by then we had separate tracks. Wonder if they realized what they had after. Did y'all realize what you had after you did it?
Nah, I didn't.
You didn't?
I just, everything was a big party back then, you know, and there wasn't nobody afraid they was going to lose their job if they didn't come up with a hit, you know.
Yeah.
So to speak, not nothing like the pressure that is today. You know, hell, if you don't sell a million the first time out, you know, bang, you're gone.
Back home to Lufkin, Texas.
Yeah.
and Ray Price was already a star.
Oh yeah, he was. Yeah.
So he didn't have to prove anything to anybody.
Right.
But it's such a clean, pretty. It's not busy at all.
No,
it's just. It's just a very clean session. I've got a friend. His name is Brian Harkness. He's 20 years old, and he's playing guitar with Ray Price.
Is that right?
Yeah. What an experience! I mean, he's getting to meet.
Yeah.
All the you know, he went to Willie Nelson's 4th of July picnic, and Willie walked out on the stage and said, "What key are they in?" You know, and tuned up and played a chorus. And
yeah.
So he's at 20 years old, getting to meet. Of course, I've never sat down and smoked a joint with Willie, but I've met him two or three times.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's getting at 20 years old, getting to meet people that I'd give anything to know. You know,
yeah.
I try not to fuss at him, make him appreciate it, but I want him to understand it. Man, what a, you know.
Oh man, he's sitting in the catbird.
Well, to be good enough at that age to play guitar with Ray Price, he's, you know, is something. Anyway, we could go down a string of list of hits that you played on, but you know, different.
Well, yeah.
You work with, I guess, everybody there is. Eddie Arnold?
Yeah, I've worked with Eddie. I never worked with Elvis and some of the younger ones, like Alabama, people like that. But most of the country people, like, Gene Watson, Tom T. Hall, Tammy, George, the Statlers, Conway, and Loretta.
On and on.
Joe Stampley, Mo Bandy, yeah.
Have your call session work, has it fallen off any, or do you still get a lot of calls? Or
no, it's fallen off. I retired, but I was out for 3 years. I had to take some chemo, and it numbed the end fingers
Oh, man.
And so I quit for 3 years.
So you had a form of, you had cancer or something?
Yeah. And I
didn't know that. I didn't realize that. What is that effect? Is that, what is, I don't know much about it.
Well, it was just a big knot had come up on my neck. And it didn't know nothing of it. Anyway, I took the chemo, and he told me that it could numb one of the fingers. And about 4
started numbing your fingers.
Yeah.
In other words, you couldn't play the piano.
Right. I couldn't feel the keys.
Whoa.
Well enough.
Whoa.
To tell.
What a thing. What a, you know.
It got, it got pretty bad. But, anyway, you're still living.
But you, and how long ago was this?
99.
So you were 60 by then, close to 60 by then. And had you thought about retiring, or were you just going to keep on doing whatever they called you to do?
I was keep on, you know, because I was still doing well at that time, and, I was just going to continue on. I was going to ride that horse as long as it.
That's right. What would they say? I'll ride this train till it slows way down, then I'll jump off.
I was about a year or so into that. I got to feeling a little better, you know.
But now, wait a minute. When this first started, you realized I can't play anymore. You know,
yeah.
Somebody'd call and say, "Listen, can you show up?" And you'd say, "Well, no, I'm ill and I can't play."
Yeah. Well, I struggled up until April of that year, April of 2000, and then I just, it got so bad, I just couldn't continue on. So, you know, when they call, I'd say, sorry, can't do it.
But it's like being blind. You deal with what you dealt with, and you deal with what you got.
Oh, yeah.
And if that's the way things are, all you could say was, my God, I had a hell of a run.
Yeah, that's right.
That's,
like I say, when I got to feeling better in a year and a half, you know, I started, got bored. And,
well, imagine.
And started trying to play again. And the more I played, the more feeling come back. It's like therapy or something.
Well, it was therapy. I mean, it would be like physical therapy, wouldn't it?
Well, that's what I attributed it to. So, anyway, when I got to be 65 and 2 months or whatever it was, when I could go back to work,
yeah,
I went back to work.
Somebody called and you said, well, all right, I'll show up.
Yeah.
And are you back to where you were before this happened?
In what way?
But I mean, your speed, your chops.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Your back up.
The feeling is back.
And the knot on your neck is gone.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I made my 5-year deal back first part of this year. So
the weird thing about things like that, I had a little heart attack in '93, and I was thinking, if this had happened 10 years ago, I just died.
Yeah.
And if this had happened 20 years ago, that'd come up on your neck, you'd just die.
Yeah. Well, you know, the type I did have was more one of the more curable types. It was 90-some% curable later.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. All right.
So it wasn't nothing like liver or lung cancer or something like that, you know.
Now, you eventually married and had a family.
Yeah, got one boy.
One son, had a family, and a swimming pool.
Oh, yeah.
Too bad. Tell me that. Mr. Roberts, what happened to your swimming pool, sir?
Well, I filled it up.
Filled it up with dirt?
Yeah, got a backhoe out here. We had a filter house and all that stuff, and he just took that thing and pushed it over in there, and the concrete decking around it and all that stuff, and
that's it.
Up and got umpteen loads of dirt, and because they had it terraced up around it, you know. And,
sure.
We just leveled it off and put all that dirt around, smoothed it out.
And that's it.
Yeah.
I just wanted Mr. Patterson to hear that. I want him to hear that they're going to be through with his sometime. I called him yesterday because my son was over mowing the lawn, and he put the pool on backwash and forgot it.
Yeah.
And ran the water down to below the skimmer, so we had to turn the system off and put some water in it. And I was adding water to my pool, so I called Don Pat and said, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, I think we're going to be filling it sometime the end of the week." Now, so they've got, let's see, this is the 1st of August. So they've got about 3 weeks they're going to be able to use it this year, because after the 1st of September, the water begins getting cold, so cold you can't use it.
That's right. I think the latest, and I was pushing it, that would be about like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
I think the last time I swam in my pool was like 30th of September, and that was cold, man. You had to like step off in there one step at a time and get used to it.
It'd be awfully cold. you wouldn't think that because the weather's still hot as it can be, and I'm sure where you are and where I am.
Yeah, but when the weather starts cooling off at night, it gets down in the around 60 or something, man, it cools that water off.
Well, the ground cools off.
Yeah.
Also, and it comes that coolness of the ground comes through that 6-inch wonderful layer of concrete you just paid $30,000 for. And all that kind of thing.
Well, sir, you know, I had my fun in it while I enjoyed it. But, you know, it's just not like a camper or a boat or something. You can't sell it.
Could sell and maybe get some money back.
Yeah, you either fill it up or move off or leave it to somebody else.
Be about it, wouldn't it? Well, sir, you've had a good life, haven't you?
Absolutely. I've been mighty lucky to be at the right place, the right time, play on the right song for the right person, and
that's right.
Just a whole lot of luck to it. I've seen the many, many musicians that are a whole lot better than I am. If I got any talent, it was knowing when to play and being able to come up with a lick that would complement the song. You know, that was where I had a little edge, maybe.
And those things that you did on songs, most of those were your idea.
Yeah.
That's this friend of mine, Brian, that I was telling you about, that plays guitar for Roy Price, is as fast as anyone I've ever seen playing guitar, but he doesn't yet quite know what to do when.
Yeah, well, you know,
that'll come.
That is, that will, and you know, that's the learning process.
He doesn't understand quite what fill-in really complements you, but he will, and I can't help him there. He'll have to get that on his own.
He will, yeah. But you know, that's I notice that in a lot of the younger players, they want to play all the time and just play 40,000 notes, you know.
Yeah.
Instead of playing something I call the tasty. Let's play a tasty lick. It might be one note, it might be four, or whatever, you know. But
laying back and playing that tasty feel.
Yeah.
That's an art,
that's in records now. You know,
yeah.
I'm not a live player. I wouldn't be worth a hoot out on stage.
I'll bet you wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
Oh, you wouldn't. You know it. Hargis Pig Robbins from Nashville, Tennessee, sir. It's been a pleasure to meet you and hear your story.
Well, I enjoyed being able to tell it. I appreciate you calling.
Thank you, sir. Hold on just a second, all right?
Yeah.
That was phenomenal, Susie. I thoroughly enjoyed that. That was awesome.
Very nice interview, Susie. Thanks for sharing it.
Same here. Boy, didn't Pig sound young in that one, too.
That was great, Susie. Thanks a lot, and I hope it's going to be somewhere where we're going to be able to copy and paste it.
Thanks a bunch, Susie. I appreciate that. And, Pig was quite a bit younger at that time, but it was a great interview.
Man, that was something else. Thanks for sharing it with us, Susie. And I could tell it was Pig, but I've never heard him sound quite that way before. I used to talk to him a little bit myself. He used to come in over on Aging Disgracefully some nights. Me and My our departed friend Glenn Schrader and I used to talk over Glenn and I. We'd be getting ready to shut it down for the night. It'd be about 2:15 in the morning, and Pig would come in, and we'd stay on there and talk for another hour. It'd be 3:00 in the morning sometime before we got out of there, but it was fun. I treasure that. The thing that I always said about Pig was he was humble. As good as he was and as much notoriety as he had, he never, you know, he wasn't, well, you know, I did that, this, and I did, he never was like that. He was just, I really enjoyed being able to talk to him, and I'm glad I got to hear this interview. So thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks, Susie. That was a wonderful interview, and I certainly enjoyed it. And Phil, I like him too. He's a wonderful singer. Thank you.
Oh, Phil Parr. Oh, that was such a good interview. Thank you so much, Susie.
Yes, thank you, Susie. That was really nice. Does anybody know how Pig lost his voice and when he lost it?
I think he had a recurrence of cancer. I think he said in 17. I'm not sure. Ralph would know that better than me. But that was 17 years ago.
But yeah, that was great, Susie. Thank you very much. Yeah, yeah, Pig was very humble, and it was a pleasure knowing him. Didn't know him for a long time, but boy, he's right in there with the rest of us.
Susie, thank you. I appreciate hearing Phil Parr again. It was a very good interview, and Pig was one of those people who. He just treats you like anybody else. The old golden rule applied to him. He wasn't uppity at all.
That was a very nice interview. And what I found interesting was the piano playing of the interview. But I really enjoyed it otherwise.
Yeah, Susie, he had a recurrence of the Hodgkin's lymphoma back in, I think it was about 1917. Or 2017, I mean, and it not only affected his voice, but it also affected the way he held his head. His head listed to the side severely after that second round. So, but I remember the old, brought back a lot of memories, the old Murray Nash studio. I think it was up there on 3rd Avenue. And, I've been in there with Pig when I was still in high school when he was doing some of the demo stuff, and also with Ronald Bridges. Ronald Bridges did a lot of demo stuff in there as well on drums, so brought back a lot of memories, that old studio.
Thank you so much, Susie. Sure do appreciate it. Thank you.
That was good, Susie. I'm glad you done that. It was Pig, and Pig would like it.
Very well done, Susie. I didn't know him at all. I really wish I had. You know, he's quite a person.
Phil had these get-togethers, which is where I first met Carla, in Houston in 2004, 6, and 8. Those of us who went to the conventions, the first year especially, he said, I need people to interview. I need people to interview. And he would call every once in a while and say, you got to find me somebody to interview. Well, somehow or another, I had talked to Pig on the phone, and I mentioned to Phil. And he said, do you have his phone number? And I said, yes, I'm not going to ask him. He said, well, give me his phone number. So Phil called him. Didn't this answer a lot of questions that you all have always had about Pig? And wasn't he relaxed?
Yeah, he was laughing, having a good old time with it. That was great. So you had between 34 and 40 people in here off and on.
Yes, Susie, he did sound great. Thanks so much for playing that. I loved it.
Well, I was amazed. He was a darkroom tech. I was a darkroom tech, but I worked for a hospital. But I was like, wow, we had something in common.
Well, it was an absolute treat for me to be able to pull it out and play it.
Thank you, Susie, and thank you, Terry, for making sure I heard it.
Thank you, Susie, for doing that. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it.
Well, this was a very sweet evening. Thanks so much, y'all. Thank you so much, Susie.
Well, you are more than welcome, and thanks, everybody, for coming.
This has been a presentation of VIP Conduit.